Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome. Thank you for joining us today. This is an hour devoted to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, but about how, what, and why we think and believe as we do. An hour for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know, who we are, and who we might become. I am Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and my partner Ravinder awaits you there now. You can log on by going to eldontaylor.com/chat. That's eldontaylor.com. As she says, emphasize, /chat. So Ravinder, say hello to everyone and lend us your wisdom of the day.
Are you trying to say I'm repetitive? Never. eldontaylor.com/chat is where the chat room goes on and where we have lots of fun, and it's an absolute marvelous day. I would love for you to come in and join me.
All right. Every week I read some of your letters as our way of paying respect to the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week, our featured guest was Lisa Gibbons, and according to your letters and comments, you enjoyed her as much as I did. Melody wrote, Lisa's lovely. Monica wrote, you were really good together. Cheryl wrote, Lisa's voice is hypnotic. I was mesmerized by how she said what she said. Didn't you tell me last week you thought her voice was hypnotic, Ralph?
I did. Really smooth.
I missed that. Really smooth. Hypnotic, huh? Mm-hmm. All right. Cynthia wrote, great guest. I bought her book right away. I just love her honesty. Martin wrote, I decided to reboot my operating system, and I can't believe the difference it makes in my attitude, just recognizing that I can choose to do that for me. Thank you, Lisa. You know, I played with that metaphor last week, you know, the computer metaphor and rebooting the system. And, you know, that's a pretty decent metaphor. If we remember that we get that G-I-G-O stuff, we have to get it out. Any comments on that?
Oh, we definitely do. You know, I'm a strong believer in replacing it with positive talk. I'm using your inner talk myself constantly. I actually have one going on my computer right now and one going on my phone, so I'm double dosing.
You're double, while you're on the radio show, you turn those off.
No,
Juan wrote, that's enough. I love your show. You get the best guests. I love Inner Talk too. Your CDs have made a huge difference in my life. Thank you and keep it up. Maria wrote, love your Inner Talk products. They are very beneficial in my life. Irene wrote, thanks for all the great books you have written. I have to read What If once again. What a great inspiration you are to your followers. You are one in a million. I like that. Thank you, Irene.
Definitely.
You're also biased, but it's nice when, you know, some outside person writes that. Love your smile. It's too bad we don't have a camera looking right at your smile right now. Anna wrote, I just finished your book, I believe, and it is an extraordinary learning lesson for me. I recommend the book to anyone that is in search of truth and the path for who we really are. All right. Well, thank you, Anna. Thank you all for your letters. That's all the time we're going to take for letters today. But I do invite you to opine by sending your email to eldon@eldontaylor.com or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming. And once again, I both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now to today's show, The Paranormal Equation with Dr. James D. Stein. Dr. Stein is a mathematics professor who has always been interested in why scientists, whose training emphasizes the need for concrete evidence, have believed and been willing to investigate paranormal and supernatural phenomena. The Paranormal Equation is a must-read book, in my opinion, for those interested in understanding their world free of false-to-fact information and assumptions. Written by a mathematician who, until a few years ago, was an admitted skeptic, the book provides a new scientific perspective on remote viewing, clairvoyance, and other so-called inexplicable phenomena. I have really been looking forward to this interview, so let me tell you a little about our guest and get him in here. James Stein, Ph.D., graduated from Yale and attended Berkeley for graduate school. Today, Dr. Stein is a professor of mathematics at California State University in Long Beach. He has served as a consultant to educational and textbook review committees for Texas and California, and has worked on projects involving mathematics education for both the state of California and the National Science Foundation. Dr. Stein is the author of several books, including How Math Explains the World, also The Right Decision, and of course the book we will be discussing today, The Paranormal Equation. So let's get him in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Dr. James Stein.
Eldon, thank you so much for inviting me on your show.
It's indeed my pleasure. As I said, I've been really looking forward to this. I have so many questions for you today.
Fire away.
And I'd like to just jump into some heavy ones, but we should walk in first. So
okay.
Let's begin with your interest in the paranormal. I found your story about how you became interested somewhat unusual. I believe it was in large due to the Bridie Murphy story. Now, I've challenged many in the past over this one because there are still many that believe the Murphy story is true. So please share with us how this story prompted your interest.
Well, I think I got interested through the Bridie Murphy story because it was front page news on the New York Herald Tribune when I was, I probably was somewhere between 10 and 14, not exactly sure. But I hadn't really thought about the possibility of life after death because I basically came from a non-religious family and it wasn't a topic there. But Bridie Murphy was, I guess you would have to say, an individual summoned up through channeling when a Colorado housewife was placed under hypnosis and past life regression. This happened in the early 1950s. And when she was placed under hypnosis and past life regression, she started talking with an Irish accent, recalling her life as Bridie Murphy, a woman who'd lived in 18th century Ireland. And it was an absolutely fascinating story. I mean, you'd have to be, my feeling is that you would have to have really been totally devoid of interest in phenomena that go beyond our normal understanding of the world in order not to be interested in this. And so I read it, and I was, like many people, intrigued because it was serialized in the Herald Tribune, and they kept at it for a number of days. But over time, it turned out that even though there was no intention of fraud whatsoever, it was discovered that the housewife had a long-forgotten neighbor named Bridie Murphy Corkle, who had related some experiences to her. And the general impression now is that Bridie Murphy was the result of remembering these experiences that were related to her, maybe some reading of her own. And even though it wasn't fraudulent, I don't think anybody really thinks now that it was an instance of past life regression and summoning up the personage of someone who'd lived in the 18th century.
True. All right. Now, I must have you comment on something straight out of your book before we get fully into today's subject. This has been truly one of my pet peeves. And when I read your articulation of it, I knew I was going to love your book. So on page 11, we have, quote, "While I was writing this book, I did some research, some reading, and some poking around the internet. Even the most cursory poking around the internet will reveal an extraordinary number of websites that, while paying lip service to the accomplishments of science, claim that they are in possession of deep truths that are beyond the power of science to explain. Many of these deep truths that are beyond the power of science to explain are purported to have life-changing capability and remarkably are revealed in books, CDs, DVDs, and seminars promoted by these websites. To obtain access to these deep truths, all you generally have to do is shell out some money. Would you care to elaborate on that?"
Well, I think you've probably not only quoted me, but I think you delivered it with the inflection that I would have delivered if I were as good a speaker as you. I basically feel that there's a lot of fraud going on. I think you probably feel the same way. Some of it is outright fraud in the sense that people are trying to convince you that they are in possession, as I say, of truths that go beyond the power of science to explain. Some people are very well-meaning. And what you have to do is you have to distinguish between the two. And sometimes it's difficult to do so because I don't purport to know everything. And one of the things that, you know, one of the things that if you're a good scientist, you will realize that most of what there is in the universe is totally unknown. And I think one of the reasons that I came to write this book was that I'd always been interested, as you mentioned in the introduction, of why there have been some top-ranked scientists who've been interested in the paranormal and the supernatural, despite the fact that there isn't really any concrete evidence to support it. And so I think one of the things that you have to do is you have to realize that some of the material that you see gets bandied about through just repeating things other people have heard. I think the one thing that really, I won't really say aggravates me, but you see most often in some of these websites is an appeal to quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics is an extremely deep and profound subject, but although there have been a couple of books that have been written that show that there are analogs between quantum mechanics and, for instance, Eastern philosophy, I'm thinking of a book that might be familiar to you, The Tao of Physics by Friedhof Capra. Yeah. That book doesn't say that quantum mechanics supports Eastern philosophy. What it does is it points out similarities in the modes of thinking. And I have no problem with that. I think in some ways it's, you know, in some ways it's very good because you sort of get the idea that it's possible for two radically different worldviews to come to similar ways of approaching things. But the conclusions that they come to are different. And as far as science is concerned, they're things that are measurable. And one of the things that really bothers me when people, you know, when people say, well, quantum mechanics support this, is quantum mechanics deals with, at the moment, the world of the atom and the subatomic particle. And it's never even been remotely conceived of by science that at the current stage of development, it can say things about psychology or things about relationships between living entities. It's just nowhere near that point of advancement yet. And I think that, you know, I think that even though quantum mechanics is a tremendously challenging and unusual way of looking at the universe, it's a huge jump to say that quantum mechanics supports whatever a particular website does. And whenever it says, and whenever I see that, I'm really skeptical, and I would urge your listeners to be skeptical as well.
I live with physicists, and I guarantee you, I actually cut guests off and terminated conversations because of that kind of abuse, you know. But all right, we can get into things like quantum entanglement and some of this in a minute. But before we do, your opinion about the paranormal has changed. Is that correct? And if so, why?
Yes, it has. And it's changed. I won't say it hasn't flipped from complete skeptic to complete believer. But one of the things that has happened during the course of my investigation is that I realized that there were possible reasons that supernatural phenomena could exist. And in order for me to delve into why I'm a little more open to the paranormal than I was before, I do have to explain something about the thesis of the book, which you've read. And one of the things that I've noticed as someone who teaches math and is attracted to math is that when you talk about mathematics, people are usually quite interested. It's when you actually do it that they turn off. At least my students do. And I want to assure you that in the interests of maintaining your listenership, I'm not going to actually do mathematics, but I do need to talk about it a little, if that's okay with you.
Sure, of course. And I mean, that's why you're here, Professor, so do.
Oh, okay. Terrific. Well, one of the things that happens in mathematics was a revolutionary discovery in the 1930s by a mathematician named Kurt Gödel, and it completely changed our understanding of what truth could be. And in order to discuss what Gödel showed, I have to just recall something that most of your listeners will remember from their high school course in geometry. It's something called the Pythagorean theorem, and you don't even have to know what it is. All you have to know is that it's a relationship about right triangles that was discovered by Pythagoras about 2,500 years ago. And because there are an infinite number of right triangles, you simply can't go around and measure all the right triangles to see whether or not this is true. You have to prove it in the traditional way that mathematics proves stuff, namely by starting with an axiom system, the axioms for geometry, and going through logical reasoning to reach the conclusion as Pythagoras did. And up until the 1930s, mathematicians thought that all the truths that there were in mathematics were of this type. What you could do is you could set up an axiom system, and they were provable, maybe not provable by human beings, because we've discovered that there are some mathematical proofs that take hundreds of pages of tightly reasoned thinking in order to establish. And maybe there are truths which would require a supercomputer or thousands of years to prove, but mathematicians had always thought that all the truths were provable. And what Gödel showed, surprisingly enough, is that there were things in mathematics that were true, but which were not provable. And the reason that I wrote the book is because it occurred to me that I hadn't really seen a connection made between that and the way the universe is. Because the way physicists, and if you live with a physicist, you know this, physicists look at the universe as being defined by a bunch of parameters such as mass, length, time, force, energy, information, and the relationships between these parameters. And the relationships between these parameters are expressed by mathematical statements such as, you know, Einstein's most famous equation, E equals mc squared. And Einstein proved E equals mc squared from some assumptions of physics, but assumptions in the real world are sometimes wrong. And so what we have to do is we have to conduct experiments in order to establish whether or not it's correct. And in physics, as opposed to mathematics, and in all the sciences, you can never absolutely prove something is true. All you can do is show that it's unbelievably unlikely that it's false, and that's what all experiments do. But nonetheless, what I realized, and I don't think I'm the first to realize it, and as a matter of fact, I'm pretty sure I'm not the first to realize it, but I may be the first to actually put it down in writing, is that what Gödel proved about infinite systems applies to an infinite universe in that there are going to be mathematical relationships among such things such as, you know, mass, length, time, force, energy, that we're not going to be able to prove. And these things would be literally supernatural in the sense that they're beyond the power of science to actually establish them. Now, we might conceivably get a hint of them. We might conceivably, you know, we might either make a lucky guess or we might analogize or something like that and come across, you know, enable us to perceive what the form of some of these laws would be, but we could never prove it. And that means that it's, in a sense, beyond science. And the reason that I'm less skeptical about paranormal phenomena today is that the paranormal phenomena have been investigated for at least 100, maybe even hundreds of years. And there have been tantalizing hints that these phenomena might exist, but they haven't really nailed it down. At least they haven't nailed it down to the satisfaction of mainstream science. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, Edgar Mitchell, and I think this is where you're going, Edgar Mitchell once said there's no such thing as a paranormal, just very large gaps between what we know and what we call normal. But I want you to flesh out that point that you're making. I think Kurt Gödel essentially demonstrated, excuse me, but in philosophy, what we refer to as a first principles are inherently unprovable. You have explained that by comparing it to the paradox of Epimenides. I think that's a critical point. So please share that with our audience, if you will.
Okay. Well, one of the things that the paradox of Epimenides does is it creates a logical paradox. For instance, probably the easiest way to express it is just to give you a four-word sentence. This sentence is false. Now, in describing those four words, you can't attach the value true or false to it, because you can't say if it were true, then it would be true that it was false, so it would be false, true and false simultaneously. If it's false, then it's false that it's false, so it would be true, true and false simultaneously. And there have been lots of examples of paradox of Epimenides throughout history. For instance, one of the paradoxes that you'll sometimes see in religion is, if God is omnipotent, can he make a stone so big that he can't roll it? And in the Middle Ages, they said, they had the one in which they described a village in which the barber shaved every man who does not shave himself, who shaves the barber. And each one of these runs into the same sort of self-referential paradox. And Gödel constructed his mathematical statement, and it's too involved to go into on the course of a radio show, and it's technical and wonky, and so we don't need to go there. But he constructed his mathematical statement on the basis of the paradox of Epimenides. He came up with the following. He found a statement that was made about mathematics that it was either unprovable or simultaneously true and false under the hypothesis that arithmetic is bunk. And nobody believes that arithmetic is bunk. Everybody believes that arithmetic is a really solid subject. And consequently, all the mathematicians that you will talk to believe that what Gödel said is correct, that there are statements in mathematics that are true but not provable. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, so as long as we have an infinite universe, then, if I understand you correctly, there are allowances for what we think of as paranormal activity. Is that, if I distill down what you're saying, is that where you have gotten to personally?
Basically, yes. There will be things that are true that we cannot explain. Now, if you're looking for, and when I say there are things that are true, I mean true in the scientific sense. And one of the things that I did was I sort of combed what was going on in the world for things that might be true that we cannot or have not yet explained. Certainly, the paranormal is one of these things that is true, but we could be true, but we have not been able to explain. Because, as I say, we have all these tantalizing hints. And I'm sure you know that you mentioned Edgar Mitchell. He established something called the Noetics Institute for Investigation of these things. And there is a segment of the scientific community which believes very strongly in the paranormal. I think, in the book I mention, the current-day poster child for that is Brian Josephson, who's an English physicist who won a Nobel Prize for his investigations relating to quantum mechanics. And he's written papers concerning the relationship between quantum mechanics and paranormal phenomena. And my feeling is that when I see websites supporting paranormal phenomena and talking about quantum mechanics supporting it, and you read further and you can tell that these people have no idea what they're talking about, I discount what they're saying. But when somebody really bright and acknowledged bright by the entire scientific community, and Brian Josephson was a brilliant student and a brilliant physicist, and if he believes it, I think you can't just you can't just say, well, this isn't the way that it is. You owe it to truth to investigate these phenomena a little more closely. And
right. You owe it to the integrity of your discipline. You owe it to the integrity of science. We've got a hard break coming up, Professor, and so I'm gonna stop you there. But when we come back, I do want to ask you about you know, some of the other bright minds, you talk about Einstein and his insights. You know, I'll also want to know, Edgar Mitchell had an experience. Did you have an experience? Is that what shifted you? So we'll pick it up there. We're speaking with Dr. James D. Stein about his wonderful book, The Paranormal Equation. If you're not already in our chat room, now is a great time to join in the conversation. Just go to eldentaylor.com/chat. Stay tuned. You don't want to miss what's coming up after a few words from some of our friends.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. James D. Stein about his book, The Paranormal Equation. But before we get back to the show, I want to invite you to join me on Facebook. I post regularly everything from where I am and what's on next to the latest in science, technology, and consciousness studies. And from time to time, some of my own opinions about the world we live in. I also want to remind you to be sure and register to receive my free newsletter when you visit my website and get your free MP3. All right, let's go back to the show. Before the break, I promised I was going to ask you, Professor, about your own paranormal experiences. You know, there are all kinds of devotees out there because something happened in their life. What happened to you?
To me was that I had friends with paranormal experiences. I must have led a remarkably dull life because I've never, to the best of my knowledge, had a single paranormal experience in my life, unless you could call one that I think happens to a large number of people, namely you wake up in the middle of the night and you think, oh my God, something has happened to somebody in particular that you're fairly close to. And I've had that happen once or twice. I've made a phone call and I found out that, well, nothing really came of it. And I do think, you know, one of the things that I mention is that I think that a lot of experiences that people have are sort of like this. They wake up in the middle of the night, they're worried about somebody, they make a phone call or find out that that person is fine and they don't bother to report it. It's the ones in which, oops, something has happened, are the ones that attract all the attention. But you ask me about my paranormal experiences. I have good friends who are scientists, and they're people whose opinions I respect, whose intelligence I respect, whose experiences I respect, and whose integrity I respect. And one of my very good friends is a Harvard-educated doctor. He was head of an Ivy League cardiology department for a while and headed the cardiology department of a major hospital in Los Angeles. And he's told me several times that he's walked into rooms and has known exactly what is going to be in the room even before he walked into it. And another friend of mine who's extremely bright, he was my roommate in both college and graduate school. In many respects, he's the brightest mathematician I've ever met. He's told me that he not only believes in reincarnation, and he's not a person that I would consider to be religious. He believes that he can come up with a scientific proof of it. And I must admit, I'm visiting him this summer. I'm looking forward to hearing the proof because I know him to be an individual of remarkable clarity of thought, in fact, one that transcends mine. So I'm looking forward to that.
Well, I'd be very interested in that. But, you know, you're talking about events that would presuppose a precognitive kind of ability. And I'm reminded we had Rupert Sheldrake. He's been on the show more than once, and I'm sure you know Dr. Sheldrake, discussing how dogs know when their owners are coming home, the data that he gathered in studies there, or how it is that people know that they're being stared at. Now, being stared at is perhaps not precognitive, but where the dogs are concerned or where this experience of your cardiac surgeon is concerned, that I think would be called precognitive, and yet I believe you're on record as saying you don't think that's possible.
No, I don't think that precognition is possible. I think there are too many logical difficulties with precognition. The basic one being is that if you have an accurate view of the future, you can take steps to negate what the accurate view of the future is, unless, of course, there's sort of like the appointment in Samara that phenomenon that you may be, you know, that you may be familiar with. That's, you know, it's an anecdote that you can't escape destiny. But my feeling is that if there is such a legitimate thing as precognition, you can escape destiny, and then you weren't really getting the message in the first place. But I believe that there are, I believe that one of the areas in which we have only begun to delve into what science has to tell us is in brain research. If you take a look, one of the things that I'm convinced of is we've only been in the science business for about 350 to 400 years since Isaac Newton really started science, and we've only been investigating...
I'm sorry, but there are many, professor, that would take exception to that, would at least go back to Aristotle, but I'll shut my mouth. You're the professor. Go on.
Aristotle and Archimedes were absolutely brilliant scientists, no question about that. But I mean seriously in the science business, in that it underpins to a large extent civilization. And I think Isaac Newton basically started that, because if you take a look at the way we look at what science tells us and how we can use science to implement technology, even though Archimedes, for instance, and Aristotle were making tremendously intelligent observations about the universe, they were limited in what they could observe because they just didn't have the instruments that were available to Newton. Newton had microscopes, Newton had telescopes, Newton had ways of measuring and controlling things that were inaccessible to the Greeks, which limited the truth that they could, you know, that they could uncover. And of course, you know, the more accurately you can measure stuff, the more, you know, the better, the more truth you can uncover. And that's related to, in a sense, the idea of precognition and brain studies. We are not yet ready to even come close to realizing the full potential of what the brain is. The brain has been evolving for ever since, you know, for the 3 billion years or so that life has been around. And in many respects, it's the culmination of what evolution has produced. And we've only really been using it to probe the brain itself for maybe 100 years. I think that the original, you know, really serious brain studies probably only go back 100 years. And we're starting to develop technology such as, you know, things such as electroencephalographs, subtler measuring devices that might be able to detect changes in the physical environment that surround the brain. Now what we're doing is electroencephalographs, MRIs, they can measure the changes that take place inside the brain. But my feeling is that, you know, that most of what science tells us is that when a change takes place inside a system, if that system isn't totally enclosed in something like a black hole, the changes will manifest themselves outside that system. And what I believe, although I'm not a neuroscientist at all, I believe that the electrochemical processes that characterize thought will, in the future, be detectable in the surrounding environment. You will be able to detect the, you know, if you're thinking about something, it obviously produces an electrochemical change in your brain. At the moment, we have to go into your brain to measure it.
So are you proposing that, say, with your cardiac surgeon friend, that somehow this, we'll make it analogous to a radio signal, that somehow he is tuning in to a signal that already exists, and that is a function of the brain that brings this information to his consciousness, a subliminal process, shall we say? Is that what you're proposing?
Well, it's certainly what a lot of scientists propose, or at least those who believe in various paranormal phenomena have postulated the existence of something called a psi field or a psi force. And I'm sure you're familiar with this. And Einstein, as a matter of fact, when you discuss the idea of radio, Einstein had a very good friend, Upton Sinclair, who was an author and who was the guy responsible for us being able to eat cheeseburgers without being without worrying that we're going to be poisoned in the process. But anyway, Upton Sinclair had a wife whom he believed had various psychic capabilities. And Upton Sinclair spent 3 years documenting his experiments with his wife and her psychic capabilities. And he wrote a book called Mental Radio, which, like many books, you can find on Amazon.com. And he asked Einstein about to write a preface for the book. And Einstein had previously expressed that when another psychologist had asked him about whether or not physics had something to say about telepathy, Einstein said, "It seems to me at any rate that we have no right from a physical standpoint to deny a priori the possibility of telepathy. For that sort of denial, the foundations of our science are too unsure and too incomplete." So not only was Einstein a good friend of Upton Sinclair's, he was on record as being at least willing to admit the possibility that these phenomena might exist. And so one of the things that Einstein was very careful to say was that he was uncomfortable with the idea of a psi force simply because the psi force did not behave the way that all the forces with which Einstein was familiar behaved. Einstein knew that there were four forces in the universe of which he was aware, namely gravity, electromagnetism, and the weak and strong nuclear forces. And Einstein knew that all those forces fell off with distance. The further you were from the source, the weaker they became. And that did not seem to be true of the psi force, at least the various experiments that he'd seen that presumably documented it. And so Einstein said, well, if this is a new force, it's one that I'm totally unfamiliar with, and I'm not. I think Einstein was probably more skeptical about that. But nonetheless, he didn't completely rule it out because science is continually discovering things that it did not know existed. I mean, one of the things that I'm always fond of saying is that science isn't the last word. It's just the latest word. And the ground shifts under our feet continually. The history of science is the history of rejected ideas, and that's progress.
You know, I've got some technical questions, but for the sake of everybody's interest, I think let's pursue for a minute some of these different fields that we think of as being paranormal. And not everything paranormal, I believe, is going to have the same quality, shall we say, of defensible whatever. Ed Dames was recently on our show, and Major Ed Dames, retired, headed the remote viewing experiments conducted by the SRA. And I'm sure you're familiar with some of Putoff's documentation that
yep.
Science papers that have come from that. Dames argued that his people have been quite successful. Indeed, he has been decorated twice, and both of those decorations are classified. Which might be question begging, forgive my suspicion, but nevertheless, he has been decorated twice for operations within his remote viewing group. And recently on this show, he proposed that his people had seen the solar flares actually turning the Earth into a barbecue this year, in the year 2013. Now, he's made many predictions, and most of them have failed. However, he has made some, like the Koreans obtaining nuclear weapons at a time well before anybody thought that was possible. So there is a bit of gravitas that goes with this man. You, as a scientist, as a professor of mathematics, understanding probabilities and having looked at remote viewing, are on record as saying, I believe, that if there was anything to it, the government would have continued to fund it. Please comment on that, will you?
Well, I look at all the projects that the government have funded that's a total waste of money. It really, you know, well, admittedly, some of the projects that are a total waste of money have political clout and influence behind them, and I'm certainly not an expert on politics or political influence at all. But basically, in science or the military, the government usually has to be pretty sure that they're not getting anything for their money in order to, you know, in order to defund it. And the reason that we got into the remote viewing business in the first place was because the Russians and the Chinese had projects in the same area during the period of the Cold War. And boy, if we weren't going to lose the space race to the Russians, we weren't going to lose the remote viewing race. But again, it doesn't cost much money to fund these projects. And admittedly, this is a time when budgets are, you know, when budgets are extremely tight. But they were defunded when budgets weren't so tight. And certainly Major Dames knows a whole lot more about the inside of what worked and what actually didn't work. On the other hand, I'm sure willing to bet large sums of money that the Earth is not going to be barbecued by solar flares this year. Although it is true that there is a danger from solar flares that I'm sure you're aware of. Really
right,
powerful flares could knock out the grid. Now, that's that would be almost worse than being barbecued.
Probably in our day and age. But all right. How do you treat then random number generators? And that's put offs real. Or say Ingo Swann's ability is so well documented and reported, not to miss whenever they gave him an assignment.
I always enter these things with a certain degree of skepticism, and my skepticism comes from the fact that I don't know enough about these items to be able to comment specifically on anyone in particular, but I trust the scientific community. They're not infallible by any matter of means, but until the scientific community as a whole is willing to accept some of these things, I have to believe that they're basically they have the status of unproven. But I think that the scientific community is a little fails to be as open as they should be about this. I think that one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is that science is a funded activity, and two groups generally give money to scientists: governments and corporations. And each of those has an axe to grind. They want something for their money. And in general, if the government is going to give money to scientists, what they want the scientists to do is to come up with something that will convince people who are voters to support the people who supported these programs because they gave them something good. For instance, the government will dump money into health research because if they can find something good, that's good for everybody, and in particular, it'll motivate voters to vote for them. And corporations, of course, want to be able to come up with a product or something they can sell. And if you look at one of the reasons that there is so little money being devoted to it, is that suppose you were to establish remote viewing as some sort of reality, the people most likely to be able to use it are the military. And they've already looked at it and sort of rejected it. But telepathy, for instance, I think telepathy will be a reality, maybe not in my lifetime, but it'll be technologically assisted telepathy by means of the fact that I discussed earlier that I believe that thought has a measurable influence on the outside world, and at some stage we're going to be able to detect it and read it. It may not be, as I say, in my lifetime, may not be for hundreds of years, but I think it's going to be done. But if you look at the ones that are really such as ESP, there's been a tremendous amount of work done on ESP. There was 40 years of investigation by Rhine. There was also the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory. I don't know whether or not you would say that Rhine is discredited, but there was a lot of experience that, or a lot of evidence that many of Rhine's results were open to question. And as far as the Princeton lab was concerned, the Princeton lab voluntarily shut down because the person originally responsible for it basically said, we've done what we set out to do. We've shown that consciousness has an effect on the physical universe. And if we did any more experiments, we'd just be repeating ourselves. So I'm not exactly sure where you put that, but all this is information that's available to scientists. And I've had some conversations with Dean Radin, who you may know either by name or by personal contact.
We've communicated. We've talked about some of his work. Yeah.
Okay, and he certainly believes that he has a mathematical statistical tool called meta-analysis,
right,
which I could basically characterize as where there's an awful, awful, awful lot of smoke, there's fire. And it's a legitimate mathematical tool. And I think you have to take what he says, you know, what he says seriously, because he was a very, very competent scientist who rejected the backing of the orthodox scientific community and went off on research that was of interest to him. But he believes that the scientific establishment has some sort of axe to grind in deliberately denigrating this work. I just think it doesn't convince the vast majority of scientists. And since you've read my book, you'll know that at one stage I said something about ghosts, that if ghosts are ever proven to be a reality, there are going to be a large number of scientists investigating them, because scientists love to investigate legitimate new phenomena. And I think the same is true that if you can...
not to cut you off, Professor,
sure,
but I think there's two sides to that argument, and I'm not sure your representation is altogether fair. There is very much... There can be a very high price paid by someone like Dean Radin or other scientists who are willing to step out of the mold and take on research that, for all intent and purposes, challenges the orthodoxy. I mean, I've heard stories, let's just say for some making claims about the validity of the paranormal activity, their claims have coincided with some rather abrupt career issues.
That's happened to scientists outside of the paranormal. My personal axe to grind in this area is Jonas Salk. Jonas Salk came up with a radical theory of immunization, and it counteracted the views that were held by the people in the establishment in that
right.
community. And Jonas Salk was never elected to the National Academy of Sciences because essentially he'd done the equivalent of paranormal research, at least in that particular area, even though, of course, what he did was completely validated. And yes, you're absolutely right. People do risk things like that. As a matter of fact, people risk things in any community by going against the prevailing thought. It happens in mathematics, too. There are approved lines of work in mathematics, and if you go outside those lines, you're risking opprobrium unless you do something really brilliant. And
right.
I guess, we're dealing with human beings here, so it's...
The fact that the paranormal tends to be associated so strongly with spiritual, and the fact that there has been so much fraud in the area, that, you combine those two, and then you think of, men like Richard Dawkins and their influence on the scientific community, and you can see why scientists would be shy of honestly, legitimately investigating these things. Is that right or wrong?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. But they're also shy because who's going to put up the money? My feeling is that if
True.
Somebody's Aunt Mildred dies and leaves $5 million for legitimate investigation of paranormal research, somebody will bite on it. There's no funding for it. There's not only opprobrium from the community, there's no funding for it. And
right.
that's one. But I think that, I think that basically what you have to do if you're a scientist is you have to say, okay, I'm skeptical of it. But it hasn't been proven to, I don't think it's been proven to anybody's satisfaction that it's absolutely impossible. And that
we're out of time, Doctor. Professor, I'd love to keep you. In fact, we're going to have to bring you back if you're willing to do that, because I mean, of 50 questions, I think we've covered a half a dozen.
You're an excellent interviewer, and I would be delighted to come back.
Well, we'll just plan on it then. I want all of you to go out and get this book, The Paranormal Equation. You have a blog site. Give that to us real quick, please, Professor Stein.
Well, actually, I don't. But if you go to New Career Press, Career Press, the book will be listed there. It's also listed in Amazon or Google. You can
Google it. All right. And we are out of time. We will bring you back. Until next time, wherever you are in the world, remember, believing in yourself always matters.